This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. It's Friday, time for the local news roundup, and what a week it's been. Last weekend, Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson faced allegations of sexual and racial harassment of former employees, allegations detailed in a story published by Sports Illustrated on Sunday afternoon, just as Richardson took his customary place in a luxury suite at Bank of America Stadium as his Carolina Panthers kicked off against Green Bay. By Sunday night, Richardson, in a letter on the team's website, disclosed plans to sell the Panthers at the end of the season. And on Monday, he gave up day-to-day control of the team. Richardson brought the NFL to Charlotte in 1993, paying $200 million for the expansion team. Forbes recently estimated the team is now worth $2.3 billion. Putting the team on the market sent panic through much of Charlotte, mostly over fears that a new owner may lack local ties and move the team. And on Thursday, an NFL spokesman told reporters that the Panthers have been a successful franchise and should remain in Charlotte. Beyond the NFL, we'll discuss a visit by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, more violent crime, and an overlooked $5 billion deal. Joining me this week, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Q City Metro's Glenn Birkins, and WFAE's David Borex. Welcome one and all.
Thank you.
Hello, Eric.
So, let's start with what Panther fans are saying. Here are some of the reactions compiled by WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn.
I thought it was unfortunate. He seems like a great guy.
It's really disappointing to hear, especially because they're such a first-class organization.
What are your thoughts when he said he's going to sell the team?
I feel like it's a cop-out. He doesn't want to face the possible fallout from the allegations, but I also feel like it is in the best interest of the team and the organization because, you know, there will always be the negative connotation when it comes to Jerry Richardson's name now.
So, Katie Peralta, let's start with you. What happened to Jerry Richardson's legacy this week?
I think to say that it was tarnished is an understatement. We saw things kind of crumble within the course of like 48 hours. It's so weird to believe that it was a week ago today that the Panthers announced that they were investigating Richardson. And then Sunday, like 10 minutes before kickoff or whatever, that SI report came out. And then by Sunday night, I guess it was like 8 p.m. or something like that, he announced his intent to sell the team after the end of the season. So, it's interesting hearing from fans because they have this sense of nostalgia and this sense of loyalty and this love for this man who has, not only brought the NFL to the Carolinas in the early 90s, but also was responsible for, all kinds of community work, charity work. There's a football field named after him here in Charlotte. But that entire legacy has been really damaged, if not ruined over the last week over these allegations and kind of the fact that this has been going on for years and the fact that the Panthers knew about it. I think for longtime fans, it's probably really difficult to talk about this, but this is at a time when women are coming forward to, discuss allegations of workplace misconduct. He also used a racial slur at least once, and that's something that people are not taking lightly. And I think that this is it's absolutely a huge pivoting point for Charlotte because the Me Too movement has finally hit home. And, Richardson is perhaps one of the richest guys to, be accused of this kind of stuff over the last year, besides the president. It's going to be really interesting over the next several, months, years to hear how else this is playing out by Richardson and others, I guess, in the city.
I should mention that Jerry Richardson, in that letter announcing that he would sell the team, he did not acknowledge the allegations in any way. And Glenn Birkins, I'm wondering, how much of a surprise are some of these reports? Katie mentioned the racial slur on at least one occasion. When you go back and look, when Jerry Richardson ran Denny's and Hardee's, which is how he built his fortune to buy an NFL team, his company was involved in what was then, I think, the largest financial settlement of racial discrimination lawsuit. Should we be surprised?
I don't think we should be surprised. I'm not going to say that I saw it coming, but I can't say that I'm surprised. Given some of the revelations that we've had over the last several months, I don't think I would be surprised with just about anybody. You're absolutely correct that Mr. Richardson, his companies have been accused of racial discrimination. I believe Sports Illustrated even dug up a case that had been overlooked. So it was far more extensive than we even knew. I think Katie's right. I think this is going to tarnish his image. I think it's going to put a little bit of a tarnish on the Panthers. I think the team can recover. I think it's going to be a bit more difficult for him to recover.
Players and coaches reacted to Jerry Richardson's decision with disappointment. Here's what quarterback Cam Newton had to say.
Everything that I've heard were allegations, and nothing was actually proven. You know, it's just another person's word versus that person's word. But needless to say, man, I still think extremely highly of Mr. Richardson.
So, Kirsten Garris, I want to ask you, Cam Newton said in that clip, nothing was proven. But the NFL said this week it will still go forward with the investigation, even though he's selling the team. What did you expect the league to do, given the news of Jerry Richardson selling the team?
I think, again, in light of all the Me Too movement, in light of all these other allegations coming to a head here, I think the NFL had to keep moving forward. I mean, we've seen a lot of folks in our business, Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer, being fired and terminated because of what they've done. So the NFL can't not, move forward either. But what's interesting is you're hearing people like Cam Newton, like head coach Ron Rivera, who are saying, my experience with Jerry Richardson is this. So they aren't dispelling the accusations, but at the same time they're saying my experience with this person has been different, because I think even Ron Rivera talked about how when his house burned down, I think there was a time when Jerry Richardson stepped up and helped him. You know, after his first couple of seasons, he could have been fired, and Rivera was like, hey, Jerry gave me another chance. So I think what you're going to hear from the team is this sense of they're almost conflicted, because obviously they're hearing these allegations, they're reading the articles like we are, but at the same time they had their own experience with this man.
I think we're absolutely correct to point out that Jerry Richardson has not acknowledged this. However, if you read carefully that first team statement, it said something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing, that we're committed to a safe and respectful workplace. We have a ways to go to reach that. So there was a tacit acknowledgement that something did go on. There was no blanket denial of that by a long shot.
David Borax, I want to ask you – I'm sorry, David, I interrupted you, but I wanted to ask you about one piece of this before you make that comment, which is a week ago, which seems like 1,000 years ago, the statement came out from the team. This was kind of the first public acknowledgement. And in that statement, the Panthers said there was workplace misconduct, investigation of Jerry Richardson. A law firm from California had been hired, and Erskine Bowles, who is a Panthers investor, would preside over that investigation. New York Times this week described the NFL allowing that as, quote, a league that can appear flat-footed when managing an evolving crisis. So before you make the first point you had, I'm wondering what you thought of the notion that the NFL ever thought it was a good idea for the Panthers to investigate themselves.
Well, I'm not sure that it did. I mean, the Panthers put out that statement because this story was coming out in Sports Illustrated. And anybody who follows journalism closely knows that when there's a story like this about to break, all the people close to it know exactly what's going on. They know what it's going to say. The Panthers were aware that this story was coming out over the weekend, and so they preempted it by putting out this statement. Did the NFL give its blessing to that? I don't know. The fact that they came back on Sunday and said, we are now taking over the investigation, says to me that the NFL was not comfortable with that arrangement. So I think maybe we should take that from it. The investigation goes on in spite of the announcement that the team is being sold, and the coming months will tell us what the NFL is going to do about this. But back to my other point, we're talking about the climate and the atmosphere within the Panthers organization, and the idea that it is not perfect is certainly true, and we can point to another incident this past year, discussions over the players' protests during the anthem. You know, there was a little tug of war going on between the players and the management of the team about how far they could go in their protests. And there was a sense among some of the players that they weren't allowed to do anything, and that created this unhealthy environment for players of color who felt that there was a way that they needed to protest.
I think it's also good to note that he was like the second to last owner to make a statement about players protesting. And that has not gone unnoticed over the last, especially, over the last week, people have pointed that out. There were a number of players, or you know, a couple of players last year, Trey Boston and Marcus Ball, I believe, who were fairly vocal about the you know national anthem protests, and they're no longer with the Panthers. I think that that's also not gone unnoticed. And you know, he did invite players to his home to discuss the protests and police brutality. And I think that among the captains, at least, it did seem to you know mean something to them that he took the time to you know hear them out. But I you know it is interesting that it kind of took a little bit of pushing to get there.
Eric, going back to your question about the internal investigation, I do think it was naive that the team initially thought that that would be acceptable. I remember when I read that article thinking, this can't fly. You can't have a minority owner leading the investigation into the team's primary owner. And so I wasn't – well, I was surprised that the NFL stepped in so fast, but I think it was the right thing to do. And I think they really had no choice.
You know, there's another element to this, why the NFL had to step in and why I think they actually acted as quickly as they could here. And that is that, remember, the NFL has been cracking down on players' conduct, you know, domestic violence incidents and that sort of thing. We've had numerous examples of that. And to let a player, to let an owner off the hook here would look pretty bad for the NFL if they were doing something different with the players.
Well, and I wanted to mention, Katie and Glenn were both talking a little bit about, you know, some of the issues with, a lot of the focus has been on the sexual harassment and the details in Sports Illustrated, Jeans Day, and the way Jerry Richardson spoke to some of his employees and former employees. But the racial side of this, I think, is maybe a little bit overlooked so far. But remember, Jerry Richardson raised a lot of eyebrows when he went on the Charlie Rose show, back when Charlie Rose had a show, and said that he had advised Cam Newton not to get tattoos or piercings and things like that. So I do think it's going to be interesting what comes out sort of in both elements with his investigation.
And we kind of talked about it a little bit before we started the show, saying how people were saying, well, Jerry Richardson was brought up in a different era. This is how they did things back in his day. People saying not excusing what he did, but using that as a somewhat of an excuse for why he did what he did. But I think we aren't really talking about the racial aspect when you look at the NFL, the majority of the players are African-American. So it is something that maybe will come up in the future as we find out what happens with this investigation.
And we started out here with the fan reactions. We played some of those clips, and one of the people that we talked to, you know, some of them say, I'm still cheering the team on. I'm excited about our prospects for this year. But some are like, you know, it's going to make me less excited to cheer for the team. We talked to one guy who said that he was particularly disturbed by the allegations of racial slurs and that really made him think differently about the team. And it's not the majority of fans, I don't think, but it is a minority. And it kind of, as we said at the beginning, it tarnishes both Richardson's reputation and the Panthers.
I think part of the reason that we've not gotten as worked up about that part of it is that we have fewer details. We have many more details about what was said and what was done in terms of sexual harassment, but all we know is that at least once he is alleged to have made a racist remark toward an African American
scout.
Mm-hmm. And that's as much as we know.
That was the voice of Glenn Birkins. You're listening to the Local News Roundup here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. When we come back, we're going to try and turn the page a little bit and look at the future of the Carolina Panthers, what happens to Bank of America Stadium, who might be interested in buying the team. And oh, by the way, are they still going to be calling Charlotte home in the long-term future? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes this morning from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Very Merry Holiday Special with Broadway hits such as Phantom of the Opera, The Humans, and Beautiful, the Carol King musical. Parking is included. Information at blumenthalarts.org/verymerry. And Hyatt Coin Shop, serving coin collectors and precious metals investors in Charlotte, buying, selling, and performing estate appraisals since 1959. More information at hyattcoins.com. Monday on Charlotte Talks, we add to your Christmas soundtrack courtesy of Tim Rice. One of the world's most successful lyricists, he has written the words to music by Andrew Lloyd Webber, Elton John, and many others. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's won Golden Globes, Oscars, Tonys, and a Grammy. Tim Rice reflects on his music and career, and we hear some live performances of his songs. That's Christmas morning, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Gelton. Coming up on the next On Point, a big GOP tax win, Trump's national security vision, a deadly train crash in Washington State. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up in the next On Point from NPR.
The look back at the week's news continues at 10 with On Point following Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg. I'm in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to the local news roundup. On the panel today, we have Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Katie Peralta with the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, and David Borax from WFAE. As I mentioned when we were heading to the break, the Panthers own their stadium, which opened in 1996. It's among the oldest in the NFL. You have teams such as the Atlanta Falcons right down the road who are opening new billion-dollar palaces that bring in a lot more revenue. And so fans and Charlotte leaders are wondering whether the next owner will want a new home field and several hundred million dollars from the taxpayers to help pay for that. So, Kirsten, I think you were reporting a little bit on the city response. What did they tell you?
Well, the city wants to do what they can to keep the Charlotte Panthers, the Carolina Panthers here. Obviously, again, Charlotte is on the mind for a lot of folks, and they want to keep the Panthers here. For those who don't know, in 2013, Charlotte City Council entered into agreement with the Carolina Panthers to have them call Charlotte home for at least 10 years. That was the agreement. But they're only obligated to be here until 2019. So it's kind of a little bit of a foggy area, gray area, because, yes, they signed this deal for 10 years, but they could walk away in 2019 no matter who the owner is. So what we're seeing is that city council is kind of in limbo because they're like, we can't really, you know, move forward until we know there's a new owner. But they said they do want to work with a new owner, whoever that is. They prefer a local owner because obviously a local owner or ownership group would appreciate what the Panthers mean to Charlotte, how important it is to this community. So we will see. But the city has invested several million dollars, close to $70 million to help renovate the stadium. And that's honestly why they didn't really want to go down the path of Major League Soccer. In the back of their mind, they were thinking, okay, in a couple of years, we might be asked for more money to invest in Bank of America Stadium. So they're kind of in limbo right now, but again, a lot of folks on city council want to say, hey, we're willing to work with whoever comes in to make sure they stay in Charlotte.
And yesterday there was a national teleconference, and Joe Lockhart, who's an NFL spokesman, said that the league perspective is that the Panthers have been successful and should stay in Charlotte, whoever the next owner will be. They've sold out every home game, with the exception of two, since 1996. Here's what Pat Risch of Washington University in St. Louis told me this week about the Panthers' future.
The Panthers certainly have a stronghold on that city and also the region. So if you're a potential owner, you've got to look at those metrics and say to yourself, this is actually a pretty strong market for football.
So, Glenn, how confident are you?
I'm fairly confident that the team will stay in Charlotte, at least for the near future. Longer term, I think that's a little more murky. But before we start to talk about whether the team will stay in Charlotte, I want to engage in the guessing game about who might end up with the
team.
That's
where I was going next. So beautiful segue.
Take it away.
I think the league is going to be under some pressure to have a minority owner. When you look at what's happening with the NFL players kneeling, I mean, you've got a team that is what, 70%? Where players make up about 70%, yeah. African Americans make up about 70% of the players. The owners are white men. That's not a good visual. I think the NFL is going to be under some pressure to kind of break up that old boys network. Whether it's to have a woman who's playing a major role or an African American. I think it's time that the NFL comes into, what is this, 21st century, whatever century this is. And I think given the nature of what has happened with the Panthers, they're going to especially be under pressure this time around.
Isn't it interesting that the first peeps we heard about potential new owners came from Diddy, Sean Combs, the rapper, and Steph Curry saying, I want in on the deal, putting their voices out there immediately saying, we think it's time for a minority owner. And other names have been batted around. Somebody told me Oprah might be in the running.
It's funny you say it. Somebody in the newsroom yesterday told me that if it was Oprah, that would solve every problem the league has.
Well, and Oprah
she also has the money for it, honestly.
That's what I mean.
Unlike Diddy, she's got enough money to do it.
And but, I don't know if Condoleezza Rice has any money, but she's a huge football fan.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. She'd be a good face of the team as well. Yeah.
So let's talk about what constrains this here. I mean, I think you guys have written about this, Katie, and there are ownership restrictions in the league, and it has to do with limiting the number of partners. So you really can't have a lot of people.
Yeah,
you can't
25
put
is the
lots
limit.
Of money together and get the $2.5 billion or whatever it's going to take. The majority owner has to own about 30% of it. Then the owners have to vote on this, and they have to decide that they want to let somebody new into their club. So the barrier is pretty high for somebody to get in on this.
Well, and so if you have let's just say the price is $2.25 billion, which it's probably going to be higher. You can have debt up to $250 million. So that knocks you down to $2 billion. 30% equity, and it's a cash transaction. So you have to have $600 million as the face of the franchise. So, you know, we're instantly talking journalism money here. So,
I mean, we were already going to go in on the deal, right?
So of the names you've seen thrown around, Katie, which ones caught your attention?
Well, I think Diddy was like the first one we heard on like Sunday, right? He tweeted and he put out an Instagram video. And a lot of people were quick to say he doesn't have the money to do this. I think it's kind of neat that he did start the conversation about, you know, really thinking hard about the importance of having a minority owner at this point. He talked about bringing Kaepernick back in as the starting quarterback. And I think the word starting maybe wasn't the, you know, right word to use with Panthers fans because they got pretty upset about that. But that's a good conversation to have. I think a lot of people who think, you know, who see this kneeling during the national anthem thing as the reason he's not employed, which it probably is, a minority owner might, you know, reconsider bringing him back in. But, you know, there are a lot of big names in business who are minority owners of the Panthers right now. The Levines, who started Family Dollar, the Belk family, Smokey Bissell, who had initially started the investigation of Richardson last week. And then, the guy who, oh my God, I'm blanking.
The Sonic.
Bruton Smith.
Bruton Smith.
The Smiths, of course.
Michael Jordan has been kind of floated, but he also said no comment, but he's obviously invested in the
Then
Hornets.
You have James Goodnight, who's the billionaire up in Raleigh with SAS.
Right.
He's worth about $10 billion. So
I think he's the richest guy in North Carolina,
yes,
isn't he?
He could write the check pretty quick.
Yeah, so there is a lot of money on the local level, and there's a good case to be made that that kind of ownership group could come together. At the same time, you know, Richardson will have a say in who the next owner is because he's been in the league for so long because he has such strong relationships with other owners. Experts I've spoken with have said the league might give him a little bit more deference than they would other owners who are maybe newer because he knows the business well, to be honest, you know, even if his legacy is tarnished. So the fact that he might make a case for a local ownership group with some of the folks that we have named, that might have some sway with other owners who end up voting in whoever it is, you know, after the season ends.
Kirsten, I wonder, what do you think about, you know, Jerry Richardson sort of has towered above the city in many ways. There may be a handful of business people that are on equal footing with him at most. So in a city like Charlotte that's growing, but is still kind of a small town in a lot of ways, how important is it, not the future of the team, but just in terms of people being comfortable here with the next owner?
I mean, I think that's going to be a big factor because Charlotte has rallied around the Panthers in such a way that, I mean, they call this home. It's a culture here. I mean, when I first moved here 2 years ago, it was like Panthers, Panthers, Panthers. And that's what you want when you come to a city, is that they embrace a team like this, especially in a place like us where we only have a couple of professional sports teams. I mean, we're lucky we have basketball and football, but overall, we don't have many. When some states, I think, look, L.A. has two NFL teams. You know, it's kind of crazy that some places have two of these things.
If I could bring a little history in here, though, just because it's a local owner doesn't mean that that guarantees future local ownership. Remember, those of you who've been here for a while, remember George Shinn and the Hornets. He moved them to New Orleans and, took the team out. Now they ended up coming back, and with the Hornets were a different team for a while, but now they're back with the Hornets name, and it feels like they never left. But, it doesn't mean that they're going to be here forever just because
it's a local
team. And
George Shinn, you know, David, it's interesting you mentioned George Shinn. I thought about him a lot this week because, of course, he had this nationally televised court trial. He was acquitted, but it involved allegations of sexual misbehavior. And while it was a huge deal and scandalous and all these things, it was a different time because, again, he was acquitted, but he wasn't forced to sell. Nobody even talked about him selling. I'm talking about from an NBA standpoint. And I understand the league did not tell Jerry Richardson to sell, but here you have 48 hours and this thing moved much faster.
You know, since we're digging into the past a bit, maybe we should talk about Eddie DiBartolo, the former owner of the 49ers, who got into trouble for bribery, and he was forced to sell his team to family members. Eric, I think you wrote about this week.
Yeah. Well, and Eddie DiBartolo, which I can't say well, he owned the 49ers when they were in their glory days with Joe Montana and Jerry Rice, and you're exactly right, David. He was forced out. The interesting thing is his name has surfaced this week as a potential bidder for the Panthers. So, and there's some feeling around the NFL that maybe he would be welcomed back. So I guess what comes around goes around, right?
It's been very uneven throughout all the professional leagues. If you look at what happened with the Clippers, that owner was for, I can't recall the name.
Donald Sterling.
He was forced to sell very quickly.
That was after a racial slur.
Yes, that was after a racial slur. There was and Marge Schott in Major League Baseball. She had to get rid of the team. So there. So it's been uneven throughout the professional leagues, but this is not unprecedented what we're seeing.
Here's what I'm wondering, and I think maybe Katie brought up Me Too, maybe all of us brought up Me Too, but when you look at what happened this past weekend and you have a span of 48 hours where, again, the league did not force him to sell, but he's selling and it seems like a pretty clear link between all of these events, does this establish something in the public mind that, you know, if you have similar situations that the pressure will be on to divest yourself of the team?
I think so. I think it's also going to be really interesting to see who the front runners come up as, you know, and maybe, you know, we'll know, maybe we won't. Maybe that'll be soon after that season ends, maybe not. But the process that the NFL goes through to vet these people, I would assume, would be extremely intensive, you know, and I don't know if there's anyone with like a squeaky clean background at this point, but I think it'll be really interesting to see how they look at other owners at this point. You know, if we're talking about quote unquote men of a different era, there are plenty of those who are owners of other teams, and I'm sure there are plenty who are shaking in their boots right now because of, you know, who knows what in their past. That said, I think this sets a precedent for that kind of behavior moving forward, whether it's in sports, in business, wherever, because it, you know, right now, which I think is a good thing, it's just not tolerated. And you would kind of assume, looking at the giant tax bill that Richardson is going to incur by selling before he dies, that it looks like the NFL made him sell, but it's, you know, they didn't.
I agree 100%. I think 2017... it will go down as a watershed year for this kind of behavior. Only time will tell ultimately, but we started this year with millions of women all over this country marching in the streets, including here in Charlotte. And a lot of those women were out there marching because of what our president said in that Access Hollywood tape. If you were there and if you saw the signs and if you talked to those women, you know that what I'm saying is true. They were many, many were driven out there for that. And we're ending with this Me Too movement. So we have these huge women's movements bookending 2017. I think it's going to be hard for us as a nation to go back to where we were. If you're in sports or business or whatever, it's going to be hard to go back and think you're going to be able to do certain activities and engage in sexual harassment with impunity.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, and maybe we touched on this a little bit, the vetting process for the next owner, I would think, is going to be quite extensive because the NFL just simply can't afford to make a mistake on the next one.
Absolutely. But, you know, who's going to vet him? Will there be anyone standing after this?
Journalists.
Right.
See?
We're there. We're going to get our ownership team together. Watch out.
Long live journalism. All right. Well, we're going to take a little break from the NFL and talk about a tiny little $5 billion deal that went on this week that a lot of people missed because of all the talk about Jerry Richardson and the Panthers. But, David, I know you reported on this a little bit. Snyder's Lance, a homegrown company acquired by Campbell's Soup Company. What do you think this means for Charlotte?
Well, this deal has probably been in the works for a while, not necessarily mechanically, but with what's been going on at Lance. Remember, they merged a few years ago with Snyder's, the potato chip and pretzel maker. I think Lance has been in Charlotte. It was founded here in 1913 when the family that started it started selling potato chips and crackers and things like that. This has been, you know, sort of a hometown favorite here. I think with the sale to Campbell's, it's probably the headquarters will definitely not be here. What kinds of operations remain here will are yet to be seen, but I can imagine that it would be scaled back considerably. You know, this is part of what's a larger movement that's going on in the food world. Campbell's needed to diversify what it's doing because its other products are not doing as well as they were. You know, the reason that Lance merged in the first place was the same reason. And so I think we're going to see, you know, jobs go away here, maybe some factories. I don't know. But it's probably a par for the course in the business world right now.
When you think about Campbell's, you always think about soup. And that's honestly the most I had known about Campbell's until a few weeks ago. They want to become more of a snacking company, and they say that after this deal closes that about 50% of their portfolio will comprise snacks, not just, you know, soup. Soup will be like 25% or something like that. I hadn't known before. They make like Goldfish crackers, Milano cookies, a slew of other well-known brands. So they will be thought of, I guess, more moving forward as a snacking company. You know, on the back end of things, this always means, and I hate this word, but like streamlining, you know, reducing inefficiencies, these kinds of things. That means job cuts, you know, especially things like accounting, things like distribution chains, things like I would imagine that they would probably combine production facilities, which there are some here in Charlotte. So moving forward, I think we can probably safely assume that there will be layoffs, and there have been at Snyder's Lance over the last several months. They employ about 1,300 people here in Charlotte.
And yeah. This is a good deal now if you're a shareholder. Snyder's Lance shares, you know, this price would be about 27% more than what the shares were worth before the speculation started last week. So from a shareholder perspective, it's a good deal. And, you know, let's remember a lot of the reason why things like this happen is because these are publicly traded companies. And one of the first constituencies that they're beholden to is Wall Street. And Wall Street wants to see bigger and better and growth and that sort of thing. And they want to see efficiencies being taken out. And, you know, all of that bodes well for the stock price.
Yeah, Campbell's Soup has been I won't say necessarily struggling the entire time, but it's seen its consumer base starting to erode now for a long time. I remember writing about that probably 25 years ago when I was a reporter in Philadelphia. The Campbell's Soup Company, when the founder died, or the man who invented condensed soup, I went to the courthouse to pull his will and read his will. He died with more money in his pocket than I have in my bank account.
Wow.
That was one of the things that I'll never forget. I was like, how does someone die? Because it listed all of his assets, and it literally listed how much money he had in his pocket.
That would stick with you.
It does.
$50 a share, is that right? Something like
that's
that?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And the other thing is Lance is viewed as having a healthier snack line, and that was part of the appeal, right?
They've been building their portfolio of health, better-for-you snacks over the last several years. So it's about a third of their portfolio now.
Stay with us. We'll be back for more on the Local News Roundup.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes today from WFAE members and Novant Health, whose cancer specialists and nurse navigators offer customized cancer treatment plans in the community. More at novanthealth.org/cancercare. And the Charlotte Symphony, presenting Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Four virtuosic vignettes capture the seasons, evoking sounds and feelings of each time of the year. January 5th and 6th at Belk Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. The News Roundup continues next hour with On Point, the first Republican win of the Trump era, a tax bill that the GOP struggled to get across the finish line this week, questions of bias in the Russia investigation, the president outlines a national security vision, and a deadly train crash in Washington state. That's all coming up with On Point at 10 following Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE.
Robin Ciordia, owner of The Secret Chocolatier, a WFAE underwriter. I recommend underwriting with WFAE all the time. It has been the most worthwhile source that we have done for getting our name and our brand out there. I would definitely say that you can get new customers as well as remind your current customers what you're doing and who you are.
Find out more. Email underwriting@wfae.org for details.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to the Local News Roundup with David Borax from WFAE, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Q-City Metro's Glenn Birkins, and Katie Peralta of the Charlotte Observer. This week, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in town, spoke to 75 law enforcement officials. What was he here to do, Kirsten?
So he's here to say they're going to crack down on violent crimes by starting a new crime task force, one here in Charlotte and one in like Western Pennsylvania. And basically, Jeff Sessions said that we've seen an increase in violent crimes, which, I mean, we've seen that here in Charlotte, too. We had 69 homicides last year total, and now we woke up to 86 homicides today. But basically, Sessions said this task force will allow them to have more resources to do more streamlining with federal and state agencies. But what he was vague about how this would work, because right now we already have the Safe Streets Initiative, Safe Streets Task Force, that, you know, cracks down on gang-related crime. But he said this one would be working on things like robbery. So it will be interesting how this kind of comes together, because at the press conference, I know Jeff Sessions didn't take any questions from reporters. So it was kind of more of a, hey, this is what we're doing. We have your back. Go forth and, you know, keep doing what you do. But he ended with saying that the president did have the backs of law enforcement during, you know, obviously has been a very tumultuous time sometimes with community and police relationships. So we'll see what happens with there. It's more of an announcement. We don't know how this will look, how it will work per se right now, but we'll see moving forward.
Yeah, it was a short speech, no Q&A, yeah. More of a photo op really than anything else, with some headlines about the government tackling these violent crimes. We don't know when it's going to start. There's not really clear where the money is coming from. So I guess it's stay tuned on this and believe what they're saying about we're cracking down. So.
Interesting. Or will Jeff Sessions even be there?
Well,
good question.
Interesting. One of the things he said was, quote, some people have to be prosecuted. I wish we had a better solution than jail, but we don't. And there was pushback on that because, of course, reform of criminal justice has centered on that very issue a lot. Any surprise that he would say that, Glenn?
Not as far as I'm concerned. There's no surprise that he would say that. Jeff Sessions has been very consistent in his messaging for a very long time now. So no.
I think it kind of undermines a lot of the work that's been going on here in Charlotte by city officials to find the root of violent crime as opposed to just punishing it right away. I mean, you know, we've heard conversations from city council and the mayoral candidates before the election about, you know, why are we at this homicide rate at this point in time? Do we need to look at things like affordable housing and workforce training and job training and, you know, eliminating poverty rather than just putting people in jail, because that's, you know, not a solution to the problem. It's just, you know, locking people up.
And even Chief Putney has said this all year long, is that unfortunately a lot of these homicides we're seeing aren't random. They're people who know each other, they're people who are having arguments, and unfortunately they're turning to guns and other deadly methods to handling these situations versus conversation. I mean, in the most recent shooting we had early yesterday morning, Chief Putney came out and did a press, and usually he doesn't do pressers for shootings or even homicides because unfortunately we've had so many of them, but he came out yesterday to talk about the most recent shooting where two young boys were hit in the crossfire. While they were sleeping, yeah, in their beds. Thankfully they weren't too terribly injured. They're going to be okay, but one was hit in the hip, one was hit in the arm. They're 9 and 11 years old, and Chief Putney came out and said, look, we are better than this, Charlotte. We can't be doing this. This is a family that just moved to Charlotte. This is not the Charlotte way. So, I mean, when the chief comes out to talk about a shooting, you know, that kind of really sets precedent that this is very important that, you know, he said, look, if he actually said, if you're the suspect, turn yourself in, man up and turn yourself in. That was the words of the chief yesterday. So this is serious, and it's tough to be ending the year with so many homicides.
And David, we were talking before the show. So the same week that we have this shooting of the young children who were in the hospital, we have Jeff Sessions, the U.S. Attorney General, here talking about cracking down on crime. And then this very morning, we have the 86th homicide of the year.
Right. We had it was a murder-suicide overnight. A husband shot his wife. There was a phone call like 3:42 a.m. That somebody was shooting in the house, and police got there, and the man had killed his wife and himself. Apparently, he also shot at another family member, but those two were the only ones that were hit. You know, 86 compared to, I think, 69 last year. It's definitely up. But I just want to go back and piggyback on what you guys were saying earlier. The conversation here is not about, isn't it terrible that we have this crime, this violent crime in Charlotte right now? The conversation is so much wider than that here. I mean, how many conferences and public forums have we all been to where we're talking about all these other issues like poverty and economic mobility and affordable housing and all that? There is a larger conversation going on here. I think it'll keep going on in 2018. And at least here in Charlotte, it's going to be more than just a task force solution.
And Glenn, yet another violent crime episode. There were arrests this week in the December 9 shooting of a 7-Eleven clerk, and this was a story that had really riveted a lot of people because of the awful details of
Absolutely.
What happened.
Absolutely. A 55-year-old 7-Eleven clerk was shot during a robbery attempt. People walked in the store and found him dead on the floor. And I think one of the reasons that resonated so much with people is that, as has been said this morning, typically when there's a murder, it's between two people who know each other. So anytime you have someone killed by a stranger, that tends to resonate a little bit more. I think we tend to see ourselves in that person, perhaps, that we might be shot while we're doing our job or for no good reason. But as you said, CMPD has made an arrest in the case, two arrests actually. We don't know what evidence they have. There was surveillance camera footage of one of the suspects. It was hard to tell from that photo who that person is, but they did arrest two people. I can't remember their ages. I think one may have been 44, the other one may have been like 22 or something like that. But CMPD apparently feels that they've arrested the right people.
So, you know, another thing that we're looking at this year, just you mentioned that, you know, these kinds of cases resonate because it's random. But so many of these cases are people who knew each other. My colleague Sarah D'Elia has been following this all year long, and she talked yesterday about the trend in Charlotte this year. And I think about 18 of the homicides this year were domestic violence incidents. I mean, that's about a quarter of these. So that's a major factor. But beyond that, police say that people with domestic violence backgrounds are more likely to be involved in some other kinds of violence, and that in many of these other cases, even if it wasn't a domestic violence-related homicide, the perpetrator was previously involved in domestic violence incidents. So it's something that's getting more attention. There's, you know, groups have been holding forums on it. The police are talking about it, and it is a major problem here.
Even in terms of mass shootings, there are people who are drawing parallels between people who have histories of domestic violence and mass shootings.
Let me switch gears here a little bit. Charlotte, after 3 years, finally has a planning director in a city where apartments and office towers and other things are sprouting daily. There is someone who is full-time in charge of trying to manage this growth. His name is Taiwo Yayobi. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
You got it.
So, David, let's start with you. What do we know about the new planning director, and what might top his to-do list?
Well, he's a Nigerian native. He got his degrees there. He's worked in both public and private planning jobs in recent years. He is coming into the city at a time when we haven't had a permanent planning director since 2014, when Deborah Campbell was promoted to be an assistant city manager. And I can't remember how many conversations I've had with people that have said, well, when we get a permanent planning director, we can do such and such. But number one on the agenda will be finally pulling together this unified development ordinance that the city has been working on for a while. And this would be a major update to the planning ordinance that would take into account all kinds of things that have happened in Charlotte since 1985, really. I mean, some of you guys might not have been born when the last time we
a
major renovation.
No dig to the millennials, please. Thank you.
Anyhow, it's been a long time, and it's really needed because, you know, these cases come up before the city council, and everything is considered on a case-by-case basis. The rules that we have don't really set out clearly what we want to do as a community. And so that'll really be the main task of Yayobi when he comes to town.
And what people who may not realize this, I mean, planning director, that affects everybody, because where things are built, how things are built, traffic patterns, all those things, of course, affect all of our daily lives. So this is someone that you want to pay attention to as he settles in.
And he'll be starting in January, and I'm sure the council will be all over him pretty quickly to get moving on this unified development ordinance.
While we're mentioning politics, kind of a big announcement this week. Colette Forrest, who has run the Black Political Caucus and is credited with really reinvigorating that organization and certainly playing a very large role in this year's city elections, she announced that she would step down. Any surprise there, Glenn?
I was surprised. I can't speak for anyone else because of all the reasons.
I second the motion.
because of all the reasons you just said. She's coming off an extremely good year. She was elected in February. So, 11 months after she came in, totally revamped the organization, made it much more visible, went just beyond the endorsements to whole town hall meetings to educate voters, and now she's leaving. So I wasn't expecting that.
She said in her note that she had accomplished everything she set out to do. Let's just talk about that for a minute. She reinvigorated the organization. She got regular meetings going. She increased the membership. She had all kinds of folks working with her every week. She established relationships with the news media. I got to say, in recent years, I didn't even pay any attention to the organization.
Agreed.
And most of all, the fall election, many of the candidates that they endorsed were elected, including Mayor Vi Lyles. So I think it's been a big year for them. And I think whoever takes over after her, if they even bring a portion of the energy that she has, this organization will continue to be a factor.
And it's worth noting, Colette Forrest is not going anywhere. She will still be in Charlotte, and it's safe to say with the 2018 elections here locally, I mean, she'll be a very vocal person in the community because she did make all these connections with the community as a activist, as a person, but also someone who knows us. So I can imagine we'll still be hearing from Colette in the future.
I spoke with her yesterday, and she did talk a little about her frustrations. She absolutely feels that she accomplished all the things that she set out to accomplish. But she also talked about some of the frustrations of working with elected officials who have their own agenda. She also felt a little blindsided to learn about the $1,500 fine that the State Election Commission had levied against the Political Black Caucus, and so or the Black Political Caucus. And so there was some tension there. She spoke very, very frankly about that. According to the organization's bylaws, the first vice chair or whoever, I think it's Eric, I can't remember his first name, last name, but he will now become the next chair. I think he has big shoes to fill if he's going to live up to what she was able to accomplish in less than a year.
Yeah, and of course, next year we have county commissioners are on the ballot, so we'll see what impact the Black Political Caucus has with that. But certainly with the city council and the mayor's race, it was tremendous.
She also spoke about that as well. She said she wants to see the kind of shakeup on the county commission that we saw in city council. She wants the black voters to hold elected officials more accountable. And she said she'd like to see more women, more racial minorities, younger people running for office.
We might see that because I know Dumont Clark, one of the longest serving county commissioners in one of the longest serving, county officials, period, is stepping down this year and will not be, well, after his term finishes. And I know there's been some rumblings of new people trying to step in, one being a minority, one being a woman. So we might see that change next year. And also we have sheriff is up for election again. And that's something that people forget about. A police chief is chosen, but a sheriff is elected by the people. So that will be something to watch.
And with sheriff, I think we have a reality TV star who threw his name in the ring this week,
exactly.
Correct?
Yes. Many people know sheriff, I said sheriff. It's been quite a morning. Need to get the coffee. But former CMPD detective Gary McFadden, he worked for CMPD for several years. He's on his show, I Am Homicide, and now he is running for sheriff, but he's also very active in the community. So I think a lot of people see him as former CMPD or just some guy on TV, but what people don't see is all the work he does in the community. He's very active with Heal Charlotte that works with youth. He's very active with I Speak Now, which is a group that works with the justice system and youth, again, trying to show them how the justice system works so they aren't on the other end of it. They are learning how it works so they don't end up there. So he's been very active behind the scenes, so it'll be very interesting to see how his campaign pans out next year.
Unless he really steps in it in some way, I expect him to be a very formidable candidate.
While we're on the topic of politics, I don't want to leave this program without mentioning R&D. So,
yes. R&D and the QC.
R&D and the QC.
Millennials are taking over.
we're making city council meetings cool, or trying to. So what's this all about?
Tarek Bokhari and Larkin Eggleston, two of the new members of the council. Tarek is a Republican, Larkin is a Democrat, and they, after the city council meetings, they are promising to do about a 20-minute podcast. They're going to go up to Tarek's office with his fancy studio there and make a recording about what happened at the meeting. And their first one that they did, they had as their guest Braxton Winston, another one of the new young members of the council. I think this is going to be fun. I mean, the first podcast that they did was fast-moving, and it kind of gave you a look behind the scenes of what goes on in the council. They did a lot of explaining about how things work, about the development process. The meeting that they talked about was the zoning meeting. So I think for people who maybe have not been engaged in the political process, this could be a great way to learn about it and to find out what's going on when they are not up on the dais.
And that's the thing. They wanted to find a way to engage millennials, because obviously, you know, zoning meetings aren't really interesting. Millennials aren't tuning into it. I know, it's Eli's
favorite thing.
I know, so I'm not going to tell Eli. Don't be listening. But it's something that I think I talked to a lot of the new kids on the dais, as I call them, and they are they said they really wanted to make sure millennials were engaged and not just, again, not running for office, but really knowing how the city works. And we're seeing that with Tarek Bokhari. We're seeing that with Larkin Eggleston and with Braxton Winston. I mean, Braxton was live streaming the Citizens Forum on Facebook Live. And we're seeing even the city is now using Facebook Live for their meetings, too.
So
it's a good thing for transparency, too. I think, you know, city council has been criticized for that before. So it's one step in the right direction.
So Katie Peralta, the Charlotte Observer, gets the last word. I can't say her paper's name very well. Kirsten Garris with Spectrum News, David Borex from WFAE, and Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.